maybe the time of contemplation that you have, getting in touch with nature. We're all told is a perfect antidote to being feeling somewhat blah, languishing a little bit due to pandemics and winter. The long history of women walking has been somewhat under the radar, and especially women walking and writing about it. Kerry Andrews, a senior lecturer in English literature at Edgehill University in Lancashire, loves walking as much as she loves words, and she's written an engaging book called Wanderers, A History of Women Walking. The trail, she writes, is a powerful agent of change. I had to talk to her. Kerry Andrews, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thanks so much for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
You yourself are no gentle ambler, Kerry. The inside flap of this book has a picture of you scaling a rock face, grinning from ear to ear, and it looks a very long way down.
It was a wonderful day out, actually. It looks more dramatic than it was. It was actually a very gentle rock climb. It wasn't even really a rock climb. It was somewhere between walking and using a little bit of your hands. And it was up the face of a mountain called the Mountain of the Thunderbolt, which again sounds quite dramatic, but was just this wonderful mountain on the west coast of Scotland. And there's a very boring trod that you can take up the mountain, which goes up this really steep, grassy slope. And we saw people that day going up there looking very miserable, or you can go up the scrambles of this ridge. My friend Ewan, who walks with me a lot, took me up this ridge walk, which was much more dramatic, as you can see in the picture, looking down at the town below us, looking like it's a million miles away. But it was just huge fun, and the sun was out, and it was early spring, and it was just everything was right with that walk, which is why I look like an absolute loon, grinning from ear to ear, as you say.
And you are a member of Mountaineering Scotland, just to sort of let listeners know a little more about your gameness.
Yes, though it's open to everybody. And I think one of the things that I found throughout my walking is that, yes, I've been up some big mountains, but if you saw me, I just had a baby 3 months ago, so I'm definitely not in peak condition. But everybody is able to get up into some sort of walk, and Mountaineering Scotland is there to encourage as many people as possible into the hills and mountains in Scotland. So it's a very open society. And the groups that I encountered when I moved to Scotland and that I'm part of now are very, very inclusive. So it's not about doing the epic stuff all the time. It's about increasing people's confidence, making people feel like they know what they're doing in the hills. And people have been so supportive of me throughout my walking career. Sounds too grand a word, but I've had a huge amount of help from some very kind people all the way through.
Gosh, aren't you lucky? That's a wonderful story. You are particularly interested in writers who walk, and you say the sense of the male writer who does a lot of walking is well embedded in our consciousness, but not so much female writers. Remind us, if you would please, of the male walkers before we go on to the women.
Sure. There's sort of tradition that arises in the late 18th, early 19th century that sort of centres around the Lake District in England. People like William Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who are living there, and then they go off into the hills and they compose, and they write about how they compose their epic works on these walks. And this sort of mythology starts to build up into the 19th century and later, that walking and writing go together, and that there's this sort of epic walking that leads to epic, inspirational writing. And then people come along and inherit those sorts of ideas. And you can trace that all the way through into the 20th and into the 21st centuries. So I'm thinking of Robert McFarlane's 2012 book.
Yes, I've interviewed him on those.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful book. It's a very beautiful lyrical book. And the way in which he thinks of Edward Thomas and walks alongside Edward Thomas throughout that book is kind of typical of what I mean, is that there's that sort of fraternity, this brotherliness among male writers when they look back to these male walker writer forebears. And I think it has become a little bit incestuous. It's also misrepresentative of the history of walking.
How so? Because you mean there's much more variety. It's not all that epic. It's sort of egocentric by the notion that you're suggesting. And the women are there, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely all of the above, but most particularly because women are there, and they are there right from the very beginning. So you've got William Wordsworth, wandering up all the fells of the Lake District. You've got Samuel Taylor Coleridge.
180,000 miles, he says.
Exactly, 180,000 miles. You've got Coleridge, who coins the phrase mountaineering. So they're right at the beginning. But at exactly the same time, you've got Wordsworth's sister Dorothy, who in 1818 sets off up Scarfell Pike by accident. But it's one of the first, it is the first documented account, probably the first account by a woman, and maybe one of the first ascents of that mountain at all. And she writes this beautiful account of it in a letter that she sent, and a couple of letters actually, that she sends to various friends, when she talks about how they thought they were heading up the highest mountain, it was Scarfell, but actually they couldn't reach it. They knew they couldn't reach it before it became dark. It was October and it wasn't quite the daylight length they needed. So they went up Scarfell Pike instead, thinking it was a lesser mountain, only later finding out that actually it was the highest of them all. And they have this picnic at Escaws and they have this wonderful excursion. And when Dorothy gets to the summit, yes, she notices that there's all this grandeur, that she can see all these, you know, from Yorkshire all the way through to Scotland. Yes, she notices that. But the attention of her eye is actually drawn to this ancient life that's existing on the rocks on the summit. It's a very bouldery, bare summit, it looks. But her eye identifies all this rich, teeming life and the colour words that she uses. This place is so vibrant, so energised, and so ancient. And the richness of that account is just fantastic. But those sorts of accounts, you know, women are there walking these things, but they don't necessarily write in the sorts of genres that are appreciated, are published. She doesn't ever publish that account. It's only in letters.
Oh, I see. It's only in letters.
Yeah, but they're there. It's easy to find. But all the literature of mountaineering and walking seems to just assume that women couldn't or women didn't or women wouldn't want to, but there are all these rich accounts. So, you know, that fraternity becomes, as soon as I started finding these women's accounts, this fraternal sort of relationship.
A sorority.
Yeah, it just, there is actually a sorority and it just became, I just got increasingly annoyed that people were ignoring these wonderful works of mountain literature.
Yeah, well, of course, that happens a lot. Now, for complete contrast, Anais Nin, 100 years later in the early 20th century, she loved to walk the streets of Paris and New York. And for her, there's an inexorable overlap between walking and writing. Both are solitary pursuits, but both bring fellowship. I found this really charming.
Yes, I think Nin's writing about walking, it was really challenging to what I thought about city walking as well, that there's a power there, both creative for Nin, but also sexual, that if I had walked in cities, I'd been aware of myself in that environment. But she seems to be so confident and distant. She's somehow there wandering above what's going on. She's just observing. She's not participating. This sort of ethereal presence that weaves in and out of people's lives and then notes it all down. When I was reading her diaries and her journals, it was just an extraordinary way of seeing cities that I know, but had never walked around with those sorts of thoughts in mind. She's an extraordinarily gifted describer, I think, of the possibilities of city walking.
Yes, and you know, there's a range of others. Virginia Woolf, a city walker, always been so fascinated with her, wrote what her walks let into her imagination. You've got Cheryl Strayed. She walked 1,100 miles of the Pacific Crest Trail to recover her damaged identity and forge brutally a new body. I mean, it is very, it's both bracing and inviting. I wonder for you, if you think about this as a sort of summary, throughout the 300-year period you cover, for women, is walking an accessible way, I want to ask you, of pushing limits and setting physical goals and reconnecting with what matters most? And sort of getting away from the usual expectations, is that what you think sort of motivates or animates a lot of these women?
I certainly think it's present for a lot of the women that I talk about. And I think it's what you described there, the accessibility of walking. I think that's also what makes it continually attractive to women who make up large numbers of walking societies, that I think it's available to a lot of people. And it's a way of moving outside the domestic role. It's a way of having time to yourself. It's a way of being in a different environment that I think, as a woman who walks now, I think that's one of the strongest ways in which these writers' work resonates with me, is that accessibility. And certainly a number of the women that I talk about were looking to escape somehow some sort of domestic situation. Abusive marriages, Sarah Stoddart has that, being involuntarily divorced by her husband, found huge solace because she could control what happened to her when she was walking. She couldn't control what was happening in her day-to-day life. So walking and physically pushing the limits of what her body could do, that was what she could determine would happen to her. And I think that's also something that resonates with me too, is that having control over what's happening to your body. For other women, it wasn't necessarily trauma, and Dorothy Wordsworth certainly wasn't looking to escape anything in particular, but she was conscious of the privilege that she was experiencing in being a woman who had the leisure time, the material resources to be able to walk for pleasure. So that sense of, you know, I am able to access these experiences. So there's a range of reasons, I think, but for a lot of these women, why ever they set out, I think a lot of them found on the trail those sorts of senses of release that you're talking about.
I think you've got to come down to the Southern Hemisphere and write one here, because all of these are wonderful Northern Hemisphere stories. Kerry Andrews, congratulations, and thank you for joining us.
No, you're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
And Kerry is the author of Wanderers, A History of Women Walking, and it's published by Reaction Books.